When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Coming up on this week's episode of Barb Knows Best, the podcast.
I woke up one morning and checked myself into treatment, into a six-week treatment stay. A voice in my head said, you're going to die. I was 28 years old, and I listened.
Hello, everyone. Hi, friends. Welcome back to Barb Knows Best, the podcast. It is me, Michelle, sitting here yet again with my mom, Barb, and we're back to talk about life's most interesting and important topics. And today is a big one. Hello, Mom.
Hi, Michelle.
How is it going being you today?
It's going really well, and we do have a big one today. Yes. I feel like I say that every week, but
you do.
This is a super duper big one.
I guess if any of you ever thought it was a bit that she says that every time, it's really not, because she does get so into each episode that it is the biggest topic we could ever talk about when we're talking about it.
Well, I think
at least it's for you.
I
say that in a nice way.
Well, that's what I love about our work here is in our podcast is that you always say we're here to talk about life's most important and interesting topics. And so today is a super duper big topic.
Yeah, for lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So this episode will be releasing on October 8th. So if you're listening to it on the day of it drops, it's October 8th. Hello. But today's episode is going to be a celebration of World Mental Health Day, which will be taking place on October 10th, a couple days from now. If you're listening to it when this episode launches. And we really wanted to dedicate this episode this week to the celebration of World Mental Health Day, like we said, and have a conversation about mental health and what it means to us, you know, what it means and how it planted the seed for us to start Peaceful Mind, Peaceful Life, the nonprofit that we run that's really dedicated to mental health, and to ultimately talk about addiction and mental health, which is a big piece of the mental health conversation, especially for you, Mom, and for us and our family.
Yeah, I think it's so important. It certainly is, you know, mental health, mental wellness, I like to say, we use that phrase in our work with Peace of Mind, Peace of Life, mental wellness. It really is huge. And we've gotten a little bit better, I think, over the decades and over the years of bringing awareness to it. And people are starting to understand that I truly believe it is the number one most important thing. I don't know what to call it.
Issue.
Thank you so much. Issue affecting our world and our country today.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, I love that there is a World Mental Health Day on October 10th so that we can have the opportunity in our broadcast today and our podcast to raise the awareness and talk about so many of the things that, you know, have influenced us to care deeply about mental health and mental wellness. And I am excited to be here today, as always.
Yeah.
To give our take and our experiences on mental wellness and mental health.
Yeah. So, you know, there's lots of holidays that happen, but, you know, World Mental Health Day is one that's really important to us. And I know sometimes these can go past in the calendar and maybe question, why do we have them? But mental health is important to raise awareness on a day like today or on a week like this. But it's important every day as well. You know, you and I talk about mental health and the aspects of it, Mom, every single day. And the impacts of mental health affect us every single day. And so while, yes, this is what's on the docket for the day, this is what we're highlighting today. I think it's just important to note that every day is a day that should be dedicated to destigmatizing and raising awareness for better mental health on a global scale.
And I love that we've chosen to take the direction of how does addiction affect mental health and how can it be, how can we really take a good look at it from our own personal, from my own personal experience with addiction that has absolutely affected you as my daughter of 38 years. So it's very interesting. And I have a great passion for talking about addiction. And many of you who have been following us for a long time know that I am in recovery for 40 years now with bulimia, which I believe that eating disorders are a form of addiction as well.
And a mental health
issue. And a mental health issue. Absolutely a mental health issue. And we'll talk about that today. And I'll go a little bit deeper into my journey and what has made me so passionate about it and what has helped me to stay in recovery. And most important, what has helped me to, you know, actually have a connection and a relationship with myself. And as we get into this more in this episode, I believe that the number one issue facing our country and our world, as I said, is mental wellness. But I believe the number one issue of that is being disconnected from ourselves, not having a relationship with ourselves, not caring about ourselves, not loving ourselves. So for me, they go hand in hand with addiction. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation today, Michelle.
I think you nailed on a really important topic to start off on as the disconnect that we have from ourselves impacts our mental health. And thinking about the world that we live in today, just how challenging it is to connect with ourselves, of course, but to connect with others, to find, you know, stability, safety, and, you know, assuredness of ourselves and our place in this world. It's challenging. And it's easy to understand why mental health is such an important issue and is your top issue, like you said, affecting us on a global scale. And even, you know, looking up some stats in preparation for this conversation, the World Health Organization estimates that 1 in every 4 people will be impacted by mental illness at some point in their lives, which actually it's a lot. But I can imagine each of us will have an issue with mental health, but if it's not diagnosed. But I think we will all probably struggle mentally throughout our lives.
Well, I think
in some way, shape, or form.
I think that's why we're trying to raise awareness with it and why the World Health Organization set aside a whole day to discuss it. I would imagine that a lot of people don't admit it.
Of course.
Or aren't aware.
Or not diagnosed.
Or not aware of themselves even having it. Which is 350 million people worldwide suffer from depression. So that's a huge number in connection with what you just said, Michelle. Yeah. 1 of every 4 people. The
it's
world
very
is
heavy.
Big.
And then, of course, addiction affects millions of people. And I really am excited to try to help destigmatize addiction. And maybe just you and I love to reframe and redefine words a lot in this podcast. And I would love for addiction to be one of them because I know it's really tricky. It's really traumatic. It's devastating. It's often villainized, but at the end of the day, it's a mental health issue. And, you know, we're going to talk more about that, but I think how we frame it and how we view it matters a lot.
Well, in the United States alone, roughly 20% of adults have some kind of a substance use disorder. And it shocked me a lot to see in this study that almost 10% of all the youth, you know, which is under teenage, I believe, when I was reading this study, 10%. It may seem like a small number, but it's actually huge when you look at, you know, the millions of people that are in our country, hundreds of millions of people that are in our country. 20% of adults is a really big number. Well, when we also understand that there are so many people that are not diagnosed or that aren't willing to even talk about it because of the stigma associated with mental health.
And thinking about the fact that so often when we think of addiction, our minds go to drug and alcohol. But, you know, like you said, it's eating disorders. It's, you know, there's gambling addiction, there's, you know, sex addiction, there's shopping addictions, there's, you know, I don't know where this falls into the category, but I'm willing to bet that there's studies being done on technology addictions now with our devices and being on screens. So I think in one shape or another, addiction can touch any of us, and it could be one or a list of them, which again, we will talk about further down the road in this episode. But even just thinking about it from that perspective, there's lots of arenas where addiction can enter into our lives.
And I think it's also true that we as people, we as humans need to understand better how substances, all of the things that you just listed, and there's probably more that we aren't even naming today, impact our lives. And how these statistics a little bit, and also the idea that we have such a mental health issue in our world, and in particular in our country, since this is where we live and very intimate with how much mental health and mental wellness is affecting our country. It shows that so many people are struggling with addiction. And what I'm trying to say is, when you are struggling with an addiction, if any of you listening are, or you know family members that are, or friends or coworkers, you feel like you're alone. You feel like you're the only one. And even if you read it in the newspapers, even if you see it all on social media or television, you still feel like, I'm still alone, because nobody really understands what I'm going through. There's this really wild thing that happens in addiction where you just feel like you are alone.
Isolating.
Very much isolating. Really beautifully said, Michelle. And you just feel that that's the truth.
Yeah.
And no one can convince you otherwise. And I think that's the insidious thing about addiction, which makes it so difficult, because when you isolate yourself like that and feel like you are the only one, it really gets even deeper and harder to dig yourself out of that hole of addiction.
Yeah.
So just, I want you to think about this. If you are struggling with addiction, or had in the past, or you know people or know someone, just, you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully these statistics and just the numbers of thinking about, you know, people that you even know in your own community, that people are really struggling, and you hear about it all the time. So it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is true.
Well, and according to studies, and we'll put all of these statistics in the show notes for you all, nearly 49 million Americans are living with addiction.
Yeah.
It's at an all-time high. So that is for sure that it's increased. So it was true what you said in general, that you're not alone, but it's certainly impacting all of us out there. And overdoses are the number one cause of accidental and preventable death in the United States. So that's a huge stat to sink in of what is causing accidental death in our country, and how it's related to addiction and these mental health disorders. So it is an issue, but we're going to talk about it today.
Yeah.
And I love that you're so willing, as always, on the show to talk about your own experiences and struggles, and especially in this episode, to talk about your journey to recovery and addiction.
Well, I have to say, Michelle, that every day I think, I can't believe that I'm living the life of my dreams, or that I'm actually have the opportunity and the privilege of sitting here running a nonprofit with you, Peace of Mind, Peaceful Life, and then also sitting here reaching millions of people on our podcast and just doing the work and doing the things that I love the most. I would never have imagined it. And I always said to myself, once I got into a little small part of my recovery, I used to think, if other people can do it, because I was reading so many other people's stories about addiction, if other people can do it, I can do it. And I hope that this episode today, with my story and getting into it a little bit deeper, can help you realize that you're not alone, as I said earlier, but also you can do this. We have the capability of doing this, but it is hard. It is really hard. And it takes great strength, which I believe we all have. We sell ourselves short on understanding how strong we really are. And it takes persistence, and it takes fortitude, and all of the things needed. So, you know, when you think about the word addiction, the actually the definition of it. I'm going to simplify it a little bit, but basically it's the persistence and intense urge to use something like a drug or alcohol or food addiction, all the things that will change the behavior, basically, that will produce an immediate result or relief. Immediate relief or immediate change in whatever it is that's happening for, say, me, because we're going to talk about my story in the moment. So
would you say it's escapist to kind of escape whatever pain is happening in the present moment to seek relief?
I think so, but that comes later. I don't think in the moment when I thought about when I was in the throes of my bulimia, I don't think I was thinking about escaping. I think I was thinking about relieving it, but I wasn't thinking about that it was escape from it. I was thinking about it as let me just stop it. Or let me get out of, I can't handle my life. And I never thought about it, control or anything. It just was, I can't handle my life the way it is. Let me take something that's going to help me handle it or take me into another place or a stratosphere or whatever it is, into another, energy field, if you want to call it that, or whatever we might call, just take us out of the life that we're living right now into something better or into something that's going to give me a reward or anything like that. That, you know, despite the harm or despite the negative consequences that might come from it. Mm-hmm. So it's really just about being addicted, being attached to a particular substance, thing, or activity that takes me out of my life.
Escaping.
I know, but what I want to say, I understand what you're saying. What I want to say though is I didn't identify it as escape.
I understand. And I don't want to negate any of the words that you're or language you're using for your own experience, because obviously you know your experience best. So I see and understand that. I think, and I don't think I would label myself an addict. Maybe that's a conversation for another episode down the road, but certainly I've had my own dysfunctional relationships with alcohol, and I could see how the escalation of usage of substances would be, the reasoning for that would be escapism. You know, you feel uncomfortable in the present moment. What can help me escape it or feel better or even perceive it differently? You know, people always say that alcohol is like it makes you more sociable. And so for me, as more of an introvert, oh, that's going to make me better in this situation. Let's go for it. There's probably many ways and many routes for addiction, but I just was curious your take on that.
Well, it's interesting you're saying that, because I do agree with you. It is a form of escape, obviously, but it wasn't until I reflected back and got into recovery that I thought, because in my mind I thought, oh yeah, I was trying to escape. But it's interesting to look at the idea of escaping. I was trying to change the present moment into something different. So I was trying to change myself. How can I actually handle this moment and be able to be who I thought that I needed to be in order to be liked, in order to be loved, in order to be successful, in order to acquire all the things that I was looking to acquire in my life? I needed to be someone else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the word escape is exactly the right word, but it's interesting how I didn't identify it as that until I got out of treatment. So let's move on from that in terms of where does addiction lead us, or how do we even become addicted? Mm-hmm. And I think this is, first of all, the first thing that I want to say about this episode and this recording is this is my own experiences.
Yeah.
This is not anything that I'm trying to say is exactly the word or what I'm sharing with you, my own experience in my eating disorder of bulimia.
Right.
So anything that I'm saying is something that I experienced. It's coming from years and years and years and decades of therapy and all the other things that I'll share with you, but it's my own take and my own experience and what has helped me to be in recovery for 40 years.
Absolutely. And just like with any episode of this show, we're always sharing from our personal experiences and our insights of the lived experience. And especially when it comes to addiction and mental health, there's no one size fits all. There's many viewpoints and many theories on defining, naming, diagnosing, treatments, recovery, and all of that. So that's why I'm happy that we're taking it from the lens of your experience, especially.
And I, excuse me. And I say that mostly because I've feel that for me, there is a great correlation to trauma that led to my addiction. And there's a great correlation to it being hereditary, that there is an inherent component that passed down from my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation to me. So I say these to start with my discussion of the story, because I think it makes a difference for me to understand that I didn't cause this and there's nothing wrong with me.
You didn't choose it.
And I didn't choose it. And it just, it's not, you know, to think that you're to blame for ruining other people's lives, for ruining your own life, for causing all the destruction or all the damage that addiction can do in people's lives. It's hard enough to go through the addiction, but then to blame yourself and to feel like you caused this or you're a bad person and that's why this happened to you. Or all of the things that addicts say. I certainly said it to me. There's something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. You know, as I shared my story many times on this show, you know, I suffered from bulimia for 7 years, but I grew up in a very traumatic household, very difficult, two alcoholic parents. We barely had enough money to survive. I was the oldest of five, and it was hard. It was really, really, really hard. I felt like every single day, I can't have my life be this way. I have to choose something else. I have to figure this out. I cannot live this way. So fast forward then becoming successful and doing the things that I wanted to do in my life, that being that type A perfectionist personality, because I was so deeply knowing, I guess, a deep knowing that I was the problem and that I needed to fix myself and I needed to find a way. And if I could just be successful and have the money and the power and all the things that you see on TV and now in social media that people have, then everything would be okay. And so it didn't turn out that way. I suffered from bulimia because it all started to catch up with me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I had a former supervisor in my work tell me that he could tell that I loved my job because he could see that I had gained weight. And then it just snowballed into that, oh my gosh, I'm that's my problem. I am less than as a human being. So now I need to figure out how to lose weight, or now I have to figure out how to become the perfect size and the perfect look to people in the outside world so that I could be accepted, so that I could belong to the club out there that was successful and happy and pretty and all of the things. So about 6 or 7 years, I suffered with the eating disorder, bulimia, which included all of the things that you can imagine with bulimia. And I woke up one morning and checked myself into treatment, into a 6-week treatment stay. A voice in my head said, "You're going to die." I was 28 years old. And I listened because I was so tired. I was tired of life. I was tired of trying to be what I thought I needed to be. I was just tired. And I saw an ad in the newspaper and I thought, what do I have to lose? Maybe this will fix me, or maybe this will be for me.
Can you talk a little bit about your mindset, if you can go back there, even maybe before checking into treatment, of just because you were in your act of addiction for quite a few years, right?
Six and a half, seven years.
Which is a long time. And then you said you had had enough and you had reached that breaking point or that rock bottom that we often hear about when it comes to addiction. But what was your mindset and perspective of those patterns and behaviors that perpetuated it for so long? Like, I know you said you got to that point. Also, Karen Carpenter's death from anorexia really impacted you. Reading about it in the newspaper was the impetus for you to check into treatment. But did you know prior to that what you were doing was unhealthy, especially because eating disorders specifically were not discussed like they are today?
That's a great question, Michelle. And yes, that was 1984. And yes, I was a massive Karen Carpenter fan. I loved her and I loved her music. And yes, I can tell you, it's so interesting as I just think for a moment before I answer your question that, yeah, I thought I had found the secret to life in the beginning. I didn't know there was such a thing called bulimia. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of working and it felt like it gave me some sense of control. And this is where I think addiction, and especially bulimia, I can speak highly about that because that's the disease and the addiction that I know so well, having lived it, especially bulimia, it totally is all about trying to be accepted, trying to be loved, trying to be welcome, trying to be all the things that you can possibly be in your life. And I think that that's what really hooked me in. I thought that I was doing something that was helping me. I mm-hmm. seemed to be able to get where I was trying to go because it gave me that false sense of control. If I can just control my weight, if I can just have, because I felt so out of control in everything else in my life, then it all would be well. Then it would all go well. So I never thought that I was doing anything wrong, but I did think it was shameful, which is a really, very interesting juxtaposition thing. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I thought I was just doing everything that I needed to do to become who I needed to be and to be happy and all the things. But I also felt such shame because it is such a shame-ridden addiction. So it was a very combination of that, but I used to just kind of put the shame aside and just say, gotta do this and nobody needs to know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing about, you can go through life with no one really knowing that you're bulimic.
Like a double life.
Yeah, I mean, nobody knew. So none of my family knew, nobody knew. Oh, I told your dad, yes, I had told your dad. Mm. He knew all along, and we'll get into that a little bit mm-hmm. with the whole enabling part of addiction in a little bit with this episode, but no one knew. And it was like the big cover up. And even though that can give you a little bit of a high, so to speak, on, oh, I got this handled. This is going to be okay. The other flip side of it is I'm disgusted. I'm shameful. Mm-hmm. Gosh, if anyone did know, that would be the end of me. So those are the thought things that were going through my mind. And the reason I was able to wake up that morning and say, I've got to see that ad in the newspaper and then say, I've got to go check myself into treatment, was I couldn't get out of bed. This is type A Barb, mm-hmm. who never missed a day of work in her life, who was a go-getter from 6 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night, never stopped, nonstop. And the fact that I woke up and I could not get out of bed, I could not get my body and my mind and everything together enough to get out of bed. And I even told your dad, I said, I'm going to stay home. I can't go to work today. And like, he was in shock. So that voice in the head that said, you need to get help or you're going to die was real. For the first time, I actually listened to the voice in my head that was real, was telling me a truth instead of all the other thoughts that I used to have in my head. You're not good enough. You're not smart enough. If you just lost weight, people would like you better. You would be more successful. So truly it was being able in that moment to differentiate and really connecting with my body, realizing that I can't get out of bed and go to work. I need help.
With the changing of the seasons upon us, I know just how challenging it can feel to transition from the summer to fall fashion. But Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. And then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out and add more new-to-you styles. I've been loving trying out Armoire lately. It's been a game changer for me to be able to mix and match, change things up, and keep in mind my sustainability efforts because I'm not constantly purchasing new clothes that just pile up in my closet, creating clutter and unnecessary expense and waste. There are so many benefits to having an Armoire membership. You can always have something new to wear without the hassle and closet clutter. You no longer have to feel bad about only wearing an outfit once. Armoire is a woman-founded and woman-led company, which is so important to us. And Armoire can help you actually define your own personal style. So what are you waiting for? Try Armoire today, because right now our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/barbknowsbest. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/barbknowsbest to get up to 50% off your first month. And never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
Hi friends, if you're a makeup and skincare girly like I am, you know how important the products are, but have you ever thought about how you apply them is even more important for the results that we're all looking for? Since 2019, Anissa Beauty has been leading the way in creating vegan and cruelty-free makeup and skincare brushes that are safe for your skin and the planet, which is so important to us. Known for their viral and award-winning Pinnacle Foundation Brush, Anissa Beauty has become a fan favorite among beauty lovers. What truly sets them apart is their innovation in skincare brushes, offering tools and specifically designed to pair with moisturizers, serums, and cleansers. They're one of the few brands dedicated to elevating skincare routines with expertly designed brushes that optimize the application and absorption of skincare products. The Anissa Beauty Pinnacle Foundation Brush is an absolute game changer in our routine. My mom and I have been loving adding it into our beauty routine, and it's been so fun to see the benefits and the results. The Pinnacle Foundation Brush is more than just a brush. It's a gateway to understanding that the tool that you use can be more important than the actual product. Anissa Beauty's brushes deliver value and quality like no other, which has completely changed how I apply skincare. I no longer use my hands and I let the brush do the work, ensuring smooth, even application every time. These brushes aren't just tools, they elevate your entire routine. And it's been amazing to try it out. Check out the Pinnacle Foundation Brush as well as several other amazing brushes at anissabeauty.com and get 30% off site-wide with code BARBKNOWSBEST. That's A-N-I-S-A beauty.com.
Professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, so focus is important. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, focus and quickly get through work with relevant real-time suggestions. And it works across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can sound more confident and persuasive wherever you write. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
So is your body speaking out to you in that moment that made you realize you couldn't continue?
That made me trust that true voice in my head.
Do you remember the first time that you threw up?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. What was the trigger, I guess, if you don't mind sharing?
Sure. I think it was my supervisor's comment.
So it was directly that comment.
Directly. What can I do?
The behavior. Wow.
Went out to dinner.
I don't know if I realized that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I realized it was so quickly from your supervisor saying that to you to leading to your first engagement, I guess, for lack of a better word, with that behavior.
Well, I think, yes.
So quickly.
Yes. I was thinking in my head, how am I going to fix this? Mm. You know, how am I going to fix this? I was a fixer. I am still somewhat of a fixer.
She's still a fixer.
In many other aspects of my life. I was a fixer. And so how am I going to fix this? It's like it was right in present in my mind quite often. So went out to dinner with a few people. And I remember, I'll never forget the feeling. I remember feeling so full. It was an Italian restaurant. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling so full, so full. And as we're driving home, all this is thinking in my head as I'm driving home, you know, with your dad, and we're driving. And I remember thinking to myself, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? I am so full. This is what it means to be too fat. This is what it means to be, you know, that he was talking about, you gained weight. It was all these weird thoughts. Mm-hmm. Were coming into my head. And when I got home, I actually had worked myself into a situation where I felt sick. Mm-hmm. And so it was easy. It was easy. Psychologically, it was easy. Physically, it was easy. All of the things just came together in that moment. And I remember feeling so relieved. Mm. in that moment, that first time. I remember feeling so relieved and thinking, oh, I'm so happy. I don't feel full and I don't feel heavy. I don't feel like I've eaten too much. And I remember like it was yesterday when I said to myself, I think I found how to fix the problem.
Yeah.
And I know it sounds so ridiculous, but if you have ever suffered from an eating disorder or know anyone who has, it's the way it's gone for me and so many people in being in recovery and going to meetings and stuff. I've met thousands and thousands of people that we all kind of have similar stories.
Well, if you remember, fast forward, and I think we've talked about this in an early episode of the show, me going to college and living in the dorm, and one night we ordered pizza and ate a bunch of pizza, and a girl on my floor was like, oh, I usually go and throw it up afterwards. And so we all went and did, and I came home and told you this like it was the same, oh my God, yeah, we threw it up, like that was the solution. Like in the similar, we found this magical cure. If you overeat or you feel too full, just go to the bathroom. And that was, you know, how we got into that conversation. But it is true. You think you found this miracle thing that no one else has discovered that's like the game changer of life.
It I know, and it just sounds so unbelievable, actually, when you think about it. But it also is believable when you think about
cycle, for sure.
For sure. And what I believe, though, is the impetus of all of that, and what I've discovered over the past, for myself, what I've discovered over the past 40 years of decades of therapy and continuing to go to meetings and have connection with Alcoholics Anonymous and all of the other support groups out there in our world, in our country today, is I believe that if you kind of trace back some of your childhood, that I believe that the trauma and some of the, I suffered from sexual abuse as a child, two alcoholic parents. So I have the heredity and the trauma, I believe, that would lead to me needing some form of self-medication. This is what I believe addiction is. It's a way of self-medicating because we just can't handle the pain that everyday life is inflicting upon us or everyday life presents for us. And I can speak for me again, that speaks for me. Everyday life was a chore. I mean, but I'm a very type A and go, and I really wanted to be successful and make something of my life. So I had that energy behind me as well. So everyday life was just, you know, pulling myself up and going out there and working and doing everything that I possibly can do to be the best and to be the smartest and to be the most successful. And all of those things were driving me. And so I could see when I woke up that morning and said, I'm going to die, and heard that voice, I'm going to die, I could see how that could be possible in that moment for that split second. Because I felt like I was on a crazy treadmill, and I just knew that my body couldn't handle it anymore. So I think that, you know, that when you have a mental health issue and you're trying to make your life you're trying to make your life be what it is that you think that it needs to be, but you're also then all of a sudden realizing that there's something going on here. You do get to a point after a while of saying there's something going on, but if you're in the throes of it, it's hard to get past it because of the anxiety that it produces, because of the depression that it can produce. And I believe that when you suffered a trauma in the early days of your life, or even in the later days, mm-hmm. you know, addictions can come on late in life too. They don't have to happen early in life. I was 28. Many people that suffer from bulimia that I've met and that I've talked to over the thousands of people were much younger. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to me that all of that means that we need to self-medicate because life is not something that we care to endure in its form that it's presenting itself to us, if that makes any sense. I don't know.
It does.
There's a weird way to say it, but it just felt to me like I needed to get myself more perfect. I needed to get myself better because I was overweight, because he told me that I was. And remember, if you're suffering from any kind of trauma or suffering from any kind of, you know, just childhood things or abuses or things that happen in your life, you have this deep, deep, deep desire to overcome it and be something, or to not be, oh gosh, I'm getting a little bit emotional about this. I can tell my words are starting to get a little bit jumbled, that you just don't want life to be like what you think it is. You want it to be better. You want it to be different
for yourself.
You want to be happy. I remember someone asked me years ago when I was still in the throes of my bulimia, you know, I achieved so much success and are you happy? And I said, yes, but no, I was not happy from the inside out. I had all the things on the outside world, but I was miserable. And I think that's the other thing that happened. You really start to live a life. You're fraud. I often felt like a fraud. I often felt like if people really knew what was up with me on the inside, they wouldn't have anything to do with me.
Well, that is the true double life aspect of addiction, because you are such a type A and you never let yourself miss work until you decided to go into treatment. You were achieving, making money, married, all of those things. So no one would ever suspect that you were suffering so much from the inside. And I think that that could be true for a lot of addicts where it's a double life. And so often, kind of going back to what you had said a little bit ago, if there's one thing or two things that I know that you have said my entire life, because this has been a narrative for my whole life with you as my mom, is that A, genetics plays a huge role in passing down these toxic cycles or dysfunctional habits and addiction. I mean, I know we've talked about this again on the show. When I, you know, went to my first party in high school and drank too much and was hungover, sitting down with me on the steps to talk about our family history and things that I needed to be careful of and mindful of, knowing our genes. And then, of course, watching that play out for myself in a dysfunctional way, despite me saying, oh, you know, you're being too overbearing or it's fine, whatever. All of the things that I said to you in that moment and for many moments after that, the family history thing was huge. But the other piece that you've always talked about to me is trauma and how much trauma plants the seed for an addiction. And those two pieces, and you had a double whammy of it, I think are almost unavoidable if you are a victim of abuse or some traumatic event in your life. Addiction is a very slippery slope from that. And I think that is where, you know, and we can talk more about trauma in and of itself in another episode, but trauma changes your brain chemistry. And, you know, you talk about post-traumatic stress. And when we talk about the grooves in the brain, trauma changes you. And so it would make sense to me that a traumatic event would lead someone to engage in different behaviors to self-soothe and cope.
Well, I think it's interesting, Michelle, too. What I've really discovered about myself is, and this is why do I feel this way? Why do I think so passionately about trauma and addiction going hand in hand? Here's why. If you've had a traumatic situation happen in your life, and it can be grand and big, like being sexually abused, or it can be something that maybe doesn't seem like it's so traumatic, but it is. And I was thinking about you, you know, with your hand, you have sweaty hands. And I'll never forget when you came home from school. You didn't tell me till you were much older, but when you came home from school, you have Mediterranean, you know, blood in you. I mean, it's you have the hands. I don't remember what that's called when you have sweaty hands.
Hyperhidrosis.
Thank you.
I never in a million years thought we were going here.
Well, because I remember when you finally told me about that years and years later, how embarrassing it was for you when you were young, when you were a little girl in kindergarten, holding hands with other kids. They didn't want to hold your hand. And I'm using that as an example. Mm-hmm. That may not have been a traumatic experience for you, but I remember when you told me that, I thought, oh my gosh. So it can be something like that. It can be anything. It can be being bullied. Mm-hmm. There's so many forms that trauma can take. Neglect.
Witnessing violence as a child. There's lots of
traumatic. There's lots of traumatic. Yeah. And so it doesn't have to be the big, you know, the big ones that we all understand are connected with trauma. So I say that because, and then if you have the gene of addiction, if you have parents or grandparents, or you have some alcoholism or drug addiction or bulimia or whatever, some kind of addictive gene, it is like a double whammy. And I think what I feel strongly about is, so if I've endured trauma, I don't speak about it. Who am I going to speak about it to? I didn't speak about it to anyone till I got into treatment. So for 28 years, so for a good, you know, more than half of that, you're in silence about the trauma. You don't even know what to say. You don't even know who to say it to. So you're in silence about the trauma. Then when the trauma possibly leads to your addiction, not all trauma does, but I believe that mine definitely is connected. When my trauma led to the addiction of bulimia, I don't speak about that. Mm-hmm. So just imagine I've got two major situations in my life that I'm not speaking about. I'm not talking about any of this to anyone. I'm actually internalizing it as it to be, you know, compounding that something is wrong with me. Something is wrong with me. I'm a bad person. This is happening to me on purpose because I caused all of this. This is my karma. Whatever it is we say to ourselves, that's what ends up happening. So the mind goes berserk. And I think that's why it is a mental health situation. It is a mental wellness journey that we all have to be on if we have a mental health situation happening. We've kept this all inside of us for so long. We've never talked about it. And so imagine what it's done to the inside out of us. And so the only way to start peeling the layers of that onion, which we talk about all the time, I love that, you know, getting through the inside of your life of what's happening is like peeling the layers of an onion. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of therapy, or it takes a lot of help. You cannot do it alone. It is almost impossible to do this alone. And I don't mean you have to do it with a therapist, but you have to do it with someone. You have to be able to share your deepest and darkest secrets with someone so that you can start to release them. So the someone that you're sharing them with is someone you respect and who respects you, and you trust them completely, and they're not going to abandon you or evade your privacy or yourself, where they say to you, me too. Or they say to you, Barbara, we all have our things. Mm-hmm. You're not alone. Or they say to you, how can I help you? What can I do for you in this moment? How can I help support you as an amazing, extraordinary human being? We all have to be able to do that if we're suffering with trauma or with addiction. Mm-hmm. And I think I was blessed to be able to go into a treatment center for 6 weeks. But what I came out of that treatment center knowing, because I had a glimpse, I had a 6-week glimpse of who I really am, what I actually deserve in life, which is what everyone deserves, a life to be who they are and live their lives in a way that supports their own love and care and success without, obviously always without being at the harm of other people. And I remember thinking, this is my number one priority. I have to figure out what am I going to do? How am I going to continue this journey? How am I going to continue this path? Because nothing is more important to me than starting to get a glimpse of that freedom from the trauma, having spoken to not only my therapist, but we were in group therapy, and there were hundreds of other people there that we were talking to all the time. It was like a freedom of talking about all the things that were wrong with my life for 28 years. How is I going to be able to now, you know, bring this into the real world, so to speak, and make this inner freedom and this inner world that I was just starting to get a glimpse of and starting to love so much in that 6 weeks become my reality in the outer world?
Well, certainly when thinking of addiction and even going back to the genetics of it, there's a lot of studies that, yes, genetics play a role in disposition, but, you know, you don't always have to be victim to your genetics. And studies have shown that environment plays a huge role in addiction and then subsequently recovery. And I know you have a lot of insights of environment as far as how it fuels addiction and how it, if you set the right boundaries and parameters, it can help you to stay in recovery.
I have for 40 years in recovery, I would say probably for 25 of those years, I have been talking nonstop in my work, in workshops, in recovery, in everything. When I go to AA meetings, any kind of the recovery groups or any personal things that I do, I've been talking constantly in some shape or form about we are the company that we keep. We do become the people that we spend the most time with, or we take on some of the behaviors. That's more or less what I should say, but our behaviors can lead into who we become. And so we are the company we keep. That has been my motto. We are the company we keep. So it's very, very important if you are in recovery from an addiction that you set strict boundaries about the people and the things that you're willing to be around. And that is the most difficult thing in all of recovery, honestly, because we have family members that you know, really press our buttons. We have coworkers that press our buttons. We have social people that press our buttons.
Family members that are still in addiction.
Many people in our lives may be still in addiction, because let me tell you something. When you come out, when you come into recovery, or when you decide that this is not the life that I want to lead anymore, I want to make my sobriety or my recovery my number one priority. There are a lot of people that aren't going to like it. There are a lot of people that aren't going to like it. And you have to be strong enough to say, but this is what's best for me. And that's a whole nother topic that we could get into another episode on enabling and why don't people like it when you're in recovery. I remember with my marriage, my husband, you know, we would go out and people would say, why aren't you guys drinking? You're so much more fun when you're drinking. You know, there is that thing in our society. There is that thing about so much more fun when you're doing all the things that enable or that speak to having some kind of external thing to self-medicate or to make us have more fun or to make us feel more comfortable or more free. And I think that that's a huge thing. I'll just share one story. I remember when my mom, when she had stage 4 cancer, esophageal cancer, and had surgery. And I remember the doctor saying to me,
because of her alcoholism,
he said, you're right. No, I'm glad you, because I didn't realize her liver was so bad. She can never drink again or she's going to die. And so I remember when she went home and it was a long recovery, but once she got recovered from the surgery, probably 4 or 5 months, she started drinking again. I mean, she's living with my dad who drinks, who is also an alcoholic, but not as, you know, it's a different form of alcoholism that he was. He was more or less halfway functional most of the day. And so I thought, she's drinking again. She's going to die. And that went on for several years until finally I saw her one day and I said, Mom, you're going to die. Kind of similar thing that I heard in my head. You're going to die. Please let me send you to treatment. And she was in a weak moment, you know, maybe like I was when I said, I've got to go check myself in. And she went. It was amazing. I was never more, oh my gosh, never more grateful. It was amazing going for the family day. And when she got out, I remember going to some meetings with her for a week or two because she stayed, you know, at our house. You remember her being there when you were little. You were, I think, grade school. Mm-hmm. And she said, I think it's time for me to go back home to your dad and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay. And I remember calling my dad, you got to do this, you got to do that, get all the alcohol out of the house, do this. And so when I took her there, there was still beer in the refrigerator. And I said, Dad, you can't have this. He goes, don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. I promise you. That night at 10 o'clock at night, I called Mom. I said, how's it going? She was drunk. So 6 weeks of treatment, another week or two with me going to AA meetings and going to all the things and just living her best life. She was so grateful and so happy. Took her home in an environment where my dad was still drinking and didn't think that it mattered, regardless of all the things that I had said to him, because he doesn't know. Nobody knows. You don't understand it. And she got drunk that night. And then that was it. She died a year later. So I think it's so important, but it's one of the hardest things. I often used to think it's hard to stop with the bulimia, but 6 weeks gave me the opportunity, obviously, to put some space between it, but then all the therapy and then all the meetings and then all the work and all the things that I've done in my own life with meditation and mindfulness, developing that really strong, powerful, loving relationship with myself. it's the road to recovery. It's not everything, but it's there for me. It's all the things that I need. I needed the therapy. I needed my own practice of a meditation and mindfulness practice where I actually could start to peel the layers in the inside. I needed to develop friends that like me for who that I am and who were kind of in the same, I don't know, in the same thought process of, you know, who you are is who you're supposed to be without judgment. Like, I can't be around people that make jokes about sexual abuse or women. Mm-hmm. I go ballistic inside. So I've learned about me. I can't be around people that laugh off addiction mm-hmm. and that think it's our fault or that we have to figure it out for ourselves and we're tired of the government or whoever giving more money to it. And I can't be around people that laugh and make jokes about women mm-hmm. and how they look. I just know that about me. It's such a huge trigger, but it's an okay thing when you know that about you. You don't have to wear it as a badge. You say something, but if it doesn't work, you either don't spend time with those people or you quietly excuse yourself. You know, for me, it doesn't have to be a scene. I don't really talk about how I live my life. I just live it from the inside out. And I think that the other thing that I want to say about addiction is feelings. My bulimia was to help me suppress. And that's why when you use the word escape, yes, it is a form of escape, but I never thought of it as escape until afterwards, as I said mm-hmm. 30 minutes mm-hmm. ago, 40 minutes ago. I was trying to suppress. I was trying to pretend that none of this was happening. I wasn't feeling any of this. Like, I don't need to feel my feelings. I don't want to feel my feelings. And so the bulimia, and I believe alcohol and drugs and other addictions do the same thing. They suppress the feeling that we're having and bring us into this euphoric state. And in my case, it brought me into a state of control. I got it. I got the secret. I can control it. And I think for me, it's been really honoring my feelings now in recovery. If I feel a feeling, it's important for me to feel it and say, what's going on with you right now, Barb? And knowing that no feeling lasts forever.
Final.
Yeah. No feeling is going to name who I am. It's just a feeling. So those are things. I hope it made sense for everyone, but it really is about you putting your recovery first and then mm-hmm. doing all of the stages necessary. If it's therapy, if it's talking to someone, if it's being in a community, you have to be in a community because at the bottom line of all of this, at the end of the day with all of this, I feel for addiction is you're not alone. You are not the only one suffering like this. You are not the only one that's going through this, but we need the help on the back end. It's not enough to just say I'm not alone. I'm not alone. When I walked into that treatment center and saw hundreds of other people there, I thought, oh my gosh, because I thought I was the only one. So, I mean, until I read about Karen Carpenter, mm-hmm. and that there was actually a treatment center, I thought I was the only one suffering like this.
Well, that is a huge piece of addiction, is knowing that you're not alone. And the shame piece that you were talking about too, probably the shame that you felt thinking, you know, A, that you had found this magical cure to help you with your feelings about your weight, but then also the shame of what you're doing it. I'm the only one that's doing this. The isolation and the loneliness that you feel when engaged with it is really impactful.
I think that, yes, yes to all of that, Michelle. And I think too, that we have to, if we're suffering from an addiction, we have to understand what I have come to understand deeply after all of these years. Because in the beginning, I didn't think this would be the case. I was thinking, because I am, again, I am type A, and let's do this and go on to the next thing, and let's do this and go on to the next thing. So I thought I would beat this addiction, and I would be free. I would be done. And what I've learned over all these years is, yes, I've beat the addiction, and yes, I'm free, but I'm free only because I've changed my behavior and my attitude toward the addiction. There are times in my life still today after 40 years in recovery where my mind, I will wake up in the morning and my mind will say, I'll get in front of a mirror, my mind will say, you are fat today, Barb. Mm-hmm. you have gained a lot of weight that you didn't realize you gained, or some semblance of those kinds of thoughts. Mm-hmm. And if I wasn't strong enough from the inside out to not believe it, I would succumb to it. And so this is the greatest part of understanding addiction, is sometimes the thought will come back up. Gosh, if I just took a drink, mm-hmm. everything would be okay. Back in the old days when I took one drink, I felt happy. Mm-hmm. Back in the old days when I threw up that one time, I was happy. And so we can't allow ourselves and our minds to go back into that that behavior, into that habit thinking.
Well, that's why people in addiction say take it one day at a time. Like it's literally managing it moment to moment, second to second, day to day. And like you might have a thought 40 years down the road that 40 years ago would trigger you to engage in the addiction, and you have to make that conscientious choice to have the awareness to not, to take the space before you react.
And know that I need to contact someone maybe in that moment who is my ally, yeah. or go to a meeting or do some, know that I need to do, that is a sure sign or a trigger, a positive trigger. Oh, you need to call someone right now. Like I've called you before and I've said to you, Mom, wow, that was a Freudian slip there. I've said to you, Michelle, I feel like I'm fat today. And you will say to me, Mom, you look beautiful.
Well, I'll also say what are these thoughts about?
Yeah, yeah. No, of course. Yeah, then we have a little conversation about it. But I'm just saying there has to be, I guess in closing this episode up, what I want to say is it's a lifelong journey. Just like life is a journey anyway, all of our lives are lifelong journeys. This is a lifelong journey and a commitment for your sobriety, for your recovery, for you living your best life. And even if you have the thoughts, no shame, no judgment, no doubts, it's going to happen. And having no shame about it, and having a place where you can reach out to someone to say, wait a minute, I just had this thought that I know is not true. I just need to tell you about it. Because remember, just speaking the feeling and speaking the thought negates like 90% of it. Allowing yourself to just release it is very, very powerful. So what I say often is finding your practice, and then practicing it, making it your number one priority in your life. And it doesn't have to include any of your family members or any of the people you're working with or any of the people you're with. It's truly your practice. But it does have to include other people in your life that are outside of your family, that are your friends or your dearest and most trusted friends, or therapy, you know, or whatever it is that you need. You know, and then following those things that you know about yourself and people, reading other inspirational people that have taught you things. Or the biggest inspirational thing that I learned when I got a treatment, reading some of these other people's stories that in my mind were giants in inspiration, in success, in spirituality. And they had lived really difficult, horrible lives, some of them addicts, and they made it. And I remember thinking, if they can do it, then I can do it. And so I want to say that if I can do it, all of you listening, you can do it. And then the third thing is finding your community of people, finding those community. I consider those inspirational people that I read my teachers. And I go on lots of retreats and I found my people. I found the practice that means the most to me in my meditation and mindfulness and self-care practices, because I actually love myself today. The fact that I can say that is a miracle. Hmm. And then finding your community, your people, your company that you keep, and having those strict boundaries and not allowing other people to influence you, but allowing them just to be who they are, but you don't worry about trying to change them. You put all of your attention on continuing to grow and become the greatest version of who you are.
I love that. Thank you, Mom. And just remembering that it's never too late to make the choice to heal and to recover and to work through some of these patterns. Even if it's something that you've been struggling with for your entire life, you can still choose today to choose differently. So it's never too late. And thank you so much, Mom, for sharing so much from your personal story. It was very impactful for me, and I hope it was impactful for all of our listeners.
I would like to end with one little quote that...
As you do.
Yes. And I know you and I have talked about maybe doing a part two of this because I have so much more and we have so much more that we would like to share.
Yeah, we can do another episode either next time or down the road.
Yeah, and dig into other aspects of addiction, especially more...
There's so much to say.
Well, I think especially getting a little bit deeper into the recovery process and what that actually looks like. I've set the whole thing up today of addiction and how it all can be. The actual recovery process might be a great next episode.
Yeah.
But one of these quotes are my thing.
Yes.
I think reading quotes are my thing because they're powerful. They're coming from people who are walking the walk and talking the talk. They're coming from people who have recovered from whatever it is in their lives that they recovered from. They're coming from people that are inspiring. And so this one comes from Marcel Proust. This made me cry when I read it in the very beginning. The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new lands, but in seeing with new eyes. The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new lands, but in seeing with new eyes. Mm. And really seeing who you are, you know, how magnificent you are. And we don't need to become someone else. We need to, instead of looking at something out there that's better, or I could be more perfect, or I could be this, or I could be that, just start seeing ourselves with new eyes. Start seeing the possibilities of our lives with new eyes.
I love that.
This took it out of me a little bit today, Foots.
You're going to sleep well tonight.
My nickname for her is Foots.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't said that one at all.
On the show.
I'll have to talk about that one day. Yeah, thank you so much. I do. I feel very happy, but also exhausted. And
yes,
I hope that my words made sense. I feel like
did.
I kind of went out to, you kind of tell me sometimes that you feel like I astral travel sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes she's on another planet.
And I feel,
no, it was good.
I actually feel like I kind of went out there and some other space for a second in thinking about my past and thinking about...
Well, you did. You went back to
how
the past.
It can be, yeah. So I love you all very much. Thank you for your grace and for your hospitality of having us here every single week and for the safety that I feel in being able to share my story and Michelle and I sharing our lives with all of you. I love you so much.
We love you, Mom. Thank you so much for sharing with us as always. And thank you, everyone, for listening and for being a part of the community. So again, as we celebrate this World Mental Health Day, we have a special offering with our community and with our listeners. We're releasing some limited edition merchandise. And I know, merch, how is that helpful? But all proceeds from the sales of this specific merchandise will go back to our nonprofit, Peace of Mind, Peaceful Life, where we create programs and content and workshops for mental health, meditation, mindfulness. We have a lot of things in the works for Peace of Mind, Peaceful Life. So every sale of this merchandise, where the link will be in the show notes, goes back to our nonprofit, Peace of Mind, Peaceful Life.
We connect with other people in the community that are doing mental health and mental wellness and support their efforts as well.
Yes. So link in the show notes for that. We're so excited. If you do purchase something, tag us and let us know and let us see you in the merch. We're so excited. I really, really love this merch drop. It's really amazing. We have a couple styles, something for everyone. So I'm really excited to see you all wearing the merch.
With some of our favorite quotes.
Yes. I think you'll recognize and be familiar with some of the designs. As always, if you haven't yet, make sure and like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple, Google, Spotify, so that you're always up to date with each new episode. If you haven't yet, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and Spotify and leave a review. It's so helpful for us in the show and we appreciate it so much. If you have questions, comments, concerns, want clarity on something we've talked about, follow us on social media at Peaceful Barb, at Michelle Maros, at Barb Knows Best Pod. That's the best way to stay in touch with us. You can also find us on Substack. I have a newsletter and so does Peaceful Mind, Peaceful Life. Again, the links are in the show notes. Thank you so much again for listening. Thank you, Mom, for everything that you've shared with us today. Happy World Mental Health Day, everyone. But again, remember, every day is a mental health day here at Barb Knows Best. Thank you so much. We love you all, and we will chat with you next week because, as we know, Barb knows best. Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.